Tuesday, January 17th, was one of those roaring, busy White House days. Brendan awoke early, and I stumbled into my room, back to the soft bliss of sleep, woke up about 9:30, and rejoined him for coffee and juice and the newspaper, and then up the big day, the morning on necessary household tasks, talking with Bess about our house guests, signing rooms, working with Ashton, and with Zephyr on menus. Brendan feels I'm neglecting my housework these days. Talked to dear Marnie Clifford, who scheduled for an operation. Made a date with Lyra Thomas to come see me this afternoon. And talked to Linda in California. She reports there's been no publicity. They've been strictly left alone and out of the papers. She feels a wide gap between herself and the girls she's interviewed on the California campuses. The net of it is that she feels older, more mature, more conservative than she thinks they feel. Someone had raised the question, wasn't she concerned about there being some picketing when she came out to California? And one of the girls she was interviewing had answered, if there was going to be any picketing, I'd be in it. More than half of them had protested, picketing, carrying placards, and feeling that in some way it was a mark of accomplishment. I went to the dentist and fitted dresses with Lucinda, talked to Doris Powell in Karnak about the post office, which I very much hope will be a somewhat distinguished and worthy building in my little hometown, and then a bit of rest, and at 4 o'clock, Lyra Thomas came, back from a month in Vietnam, where she had gone to hospitals and schools, ate with the soldiers in their messes, talked with them by the dozens, traveled the length of the land. She brought me a letter from Mrs. Caulfield, Medal of Freedom winner, a blind woman who worked with the blind in Vietnam. A thrilling letter. She told stories of the work of individual American doctors who are giving 2 months from their lives to work with the Vietnamese populace as well as our soldiers, and of an American woman doctor, not more than 40, who'd simply immersed her life in working for them. At a small hospital with more patients sleeping in the hall than in beds, our people are training midwives and medical assistants. It had been a singular opportunity and a hazardous one for a woman. And all the time I watched Lyra, I thought of her having been, for all these years, the wife of one of the most powerful men on the hill. And now here she is a widow, and what will she do next? And I heard the tolling of a distant bell. Brendan had discussed the possibility that she might be seeking a job. Bless him, he'd said, you've got to think of something she could do. What could you do if you were a widow? There are so many reasons why I like him. But for now, Lyra is not seeking a job. She's returning to Houston to help Anne have a third baby, probably to marry off Lyra in March. And then what comes next, she doesn't know, is uncertain. But she's an indomitable woman. A funny gift she'd brought me, for Lyndon it was a shirt made out of a sack that had held bulgur, a sort of a rough wheat product, apparently, that we send to the Vietnamese for distribution to refugees. I laughed and thought, this is the second time around in my childhood, sons and daughters of tenant farmers wore shirts and dresses made out of flour sacks. Somebody in that AID program must have a past that goes back to that. And then, after an hour, Lyra left, and my next appointment came. Joan Crawford, that glamorous woman I'd watched on the screen for so many years, now a vice president of Pepsi Cola, with Liz and Sharon and Rosemary Stroer. She wanted to tell me about Pepsi's cooperation on the beautification front. Streamers on their delivery trucks, litter bags and litter barrels to be distributed by their dealers, a line on all their TV commercials, addressed to the young people. It's your country. Put that empty bottle in the trash container. It's an endless fascination to me to meet people from the stage. And we talked theater. They're glamorous in capital letters forever. And it's always surprising to me to find that some of them and lots of people everywhere regard us in politics with the same wide eyes. Of course, I'd left Miss Crawford's name at the gate, but when she was stopped there, she said she was asked, what do you have for identification? She had answered, just my face. Ah, fame. I wonder how long that will suffice for any of us. For me, this was a good chance to thank, praise, applaud Pepsi Cola's efforts on keeping our country clean. They left about 6, entwined during the afternoon. There had been calls, or dashes up to the third floor, to welcome our house guests, Jack Joses, the Harold Youngs, the McCrocklins, the Roy Whites, Mrs. Herbert Marcus, Stanley's mother, wasn't coming until dinner time, and arrangements for them to have tours, or cars, or tea in their room. And then I had a rub, and reviewed the guest list, and went over the seating charts with Bess. Then Jean-Louis came, and with his deft touch, made a transformation between me of the afternoon and me of the evening, with my hair piled high, and I wore my very favorite dress, the Molly Parnish white with the beaded jacket. I was dressed by 7:30, and Okamoto did some pictures of me in the yellow room. Months, years pass, and I send out the same pictures, simply because I don't spend the time to get new good ones made. Our honor guests came a little before 8, and I met them in the yellow room. The Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren and their family, the John Daly's and Mrs. Carmen Clementi, the first to arrive, and then the Speaker and Mrs. McCormick, with his handsome nephew, Eddie McCormick, and his pretty wife, Miss Harriet on a cane and walking with great difficulty, and unfailing devoted assistance from her husband, the Speaker, who looked paler and more sepulchral than usual. It was only later that I found that today a campaign had been launched to unseat him from his position as Speaker. A challenge on the Hill, a column by Drew Pearson, and last to come were Hubert and Muriel, looking very sharp in a white dress, with his sister, Mrs. William Baines, and her husband, and his sister Frances Howard, who lives here, and his brother Ralph Humphrey, from back home. It's his first time in the White House, Hubert explained. And Lyndon came in, bringing Mike Mansfield and Senator Dirksen, with whom he'd been conferring. Their wives had joined us earlier. Among the wives, at least, the fresh spirit of reunion, of getting back together in January, is still abroad, and there was talk of the first meeting of the Senate Ladies Red Cross, with about 60 in attendance, and for the first time, a Senate wife introducing her daughter, who had joined the group, Luella Dirksen's daughter, whose husband is Senator Baker from Tennessee. It had about 60 in attendance. I missed them. Some Tuesday I'll drop in. At 8:15, the color guard came in, and the delightful bit of pageantry started, the removal of the colors, and the line forming to go downstairs, Leonard and I together, and then Hubert and Muriel, and then the Speaker and Miss Harriet, and then the Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren. We were already halfway down the stairs, when I remembered aghast that I should have made arrangements for Miss Harriet to come down in the elevator. I turned back to them and apologized, but it was just as easy to keep descending. The Speaker said, "She's a great soldier." So slowly, ponderously, we made it. At the foot of the stairs, Bess lined us up for the pictures, and in the brave call of "Hail to the Chief," and with head high, we marched into the East Room for the receiving line, which this time stood, all 8 of us, beginning with Lyndon, then the Humphreys, McCormicks, and Warrens, and ending with me, at the foot of the stage. How crowded the East Room looked. Stage and 190 guests, and you sacrifice something of the elegance of the smaller dinner. But this is always one of the happiest parties of the year. Everybody knows everybody. First, all the cabinet, including the newly sworn in Allen Boyd and Flavel, and all the Supreme Court, and much of the top echelon of the House and Senate, the McClellans and Russell Long, and Everett and Luella Dirksen, and affable Tom Keeker with Pretty Betty, Mike and Maureen Mansfield, the young and attractive Walter Mondales, he's Hubert's colleague, former colleague, and there were 2 governors, Nelson Rockefeller and Happy, very soon to have their second child, it seems. How quickly the wheel of fortune turns. I'm glad that in both its down sweeps and upward surges, and now is certainly one, we've liked him, and he, I believe, has liked us. And young and attractive Governor Guy and Mrs. Guy of North Dakota. Well, it was a slow line, what with 8 of us in it, and half the people pausing to hug and kiss each other. It's the reunion time of year. And then there were lots of the special friends of the Humphreys and the McCormicks and the Chief Justice, invited for the occasion because it was their party. And Minnesota and California and Massachusetts were represented well. I delight particularly in them sharing it with those they love. From the government, there were the Ramsey Clarks and the Thurgood Marshalls, and Saul Linowitz, full of enthusiasm for his job and optimism, and Farris Bryant, the shepherd of the governors, with his lovely wife. From our staff, the Califanos and Watsons and George Christian, who must be indoctrinated by knowing everybody, and Mike Manatos, whose daily job it is to deal with the Congress, and Liz Carpenter, and a sizable number of other House members, Annie Sella, and Republican stalwarts Les Ahrens and Charlie Halleck, and two Texans who have survived the years through important committee assignments, the George Mahons and the Bob Pogues. Other Southerners who wield a heavy power in the House, Wilbur Mills and Mendel Rivers. Bill Boggs was there from the leadership, but not Carl Albert. On the Republican side, Jerry Ford and his pretty wife, Betty. There were old friends, the Douglas Arants from Alabama, who used to handle some legal work for me in the time of the settlement of the estate, and the Miguel Guajardos from Acapulco, associated with some of the happiest times of our life, and, of course, our house guests. The entertainment world was especially well represented. Tonight would be the most star-studded entertainment the White House has seen in a long time. Carol Channing doing 30 minutes from Hello, Dolly, and with her was the composer Jerry Herman and producer David Merrick, whom she called the money man of the show. And from my earliest memories of the great of the stage, Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne, aging but elegant. And Joan Crawford, there was a marvelous transformation from this afternoon, when her simple basic black dress could have been anybody's. Tonight, her shocking pink dress and coat announced her presence from one end of the East Room to the other. And the Douglas Fairbanks Juniors, that legendary figure to me, a pretty young Negro singer, Nancy Wilson, and a big Falstaffian character with a beard, whom lots of guests recognized as the great jazz man from New Orleans. From the education world, it was Dr. Butterfield of Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, and our own Dr. James McCrocklin from Southwest Texas State College, George Meany of Labor, advanced ponderously on his cane, and C.R. Smith, business, leaned over a minute to let me tell him how much we thanked him for his generosity to the White House. He gave the Thomas Moran painting and may give the Tate. The press was there in full form, for Dan Rathers, the nearly blind Victor Resell, Ray Shearer. Because he covers us so constantly in Texas, I feel especially easy around him, and the same for the Jack Horners, the Bob Youngs, and the Carol Kirkpatricks. When the lengthy line was at last over, Lyndon took Muriel and Mrs. Warren to the state dining room, and I went into the blue room, with Hubert on my right and the speaker on my left. Next to him sat Mrs. McCormick. They are never separated at dinner parties. In fact, in all the long decades of their marriage, he's had dinner with her every night. And then Russell Long alone, though Catherine will come up when his daughter is queen of the Mardi Gras. And Betty Kiko, always a good guest. She keeps her side of the table lively. And then David Merrick and Lynn Fontanne, who spent most of the evening talking to each other. I caught one phrase, "When have you seen Noel?" I was fascinated by Lynn Fontanne, who wore a regal, flowing, cream or gray chiffon, as queenly as her own manner. Handsome jeweled pin that looked like the czar of all the Russias might have given it to her. Her hair piled on top of her head. In her late 70s, creating the illusion of beauty, she drew me like a magnet. I looked up some of the things she'd played in ahead of time and found that they took me all the way back to my old favorites, Design for Living and Idiot's Delight, Noah Coward, I think, and There Shall Be No Night, the most stirring war play I remember. I spoke about them briefly. She told me she was doing Anastasia for TV in March. The conversation naturally gravitated to the theater, and Hubert, no surprise, came up with the liveliest stories of all. Stories of a traveling company coming to the Opera House in South Dakota. It would be named the Opera House. What dream of glory caused them all to be named that? Marshall, or Johnson City, or that little town in South Dakota. And they borrowed his mother's Davenport and rug every year, and the family got free tickets to the play in return. Hubert was in great form and carried the table with him. I was grateful because on my left, the speaker was silent and sad, serving Miss Harriet's plate, speaking gently to her, and I cudgeling in my mind for conversation with him as far removed as possible from the day's events in the house. We had sole Nina, delicious, and then pheasant Muriel, Hubert said the wild rice should be after him, and then a chocolate souffle Harriet. My heart always lifts with the singing strings. I feel that's a special gift to the guests. But next comes a problem we haven't quite solved. When we have a dinner in two rooms, those of us in the blue room cannot see the president when he rises for his toast. The murmur of voices continues. We always lose his first phrase or two, a sentence, but it was splendid, his toast. I liked especially the lines, "It was the richness of this American earth that made us powerful and affluent. It was the fidelity of men like these that made us free." These were the three honorees, the Vice President, the Speaker, the Chief Justice. In his reply, Hubert left off being funny for once and was quite serious, recalling FDR's last written but unspoken words, the gist of which I recall is there is no limit to our accomplishments of tomorrow, except our faith in today. The Speaker, when his turn came, changed from his subdued and sad manner of the evening to a tall and commanding figure. He called the White House this mansion of destiny to which few are called. Our leader today is a man bigger than life, a man close to the soil and to the Bible, a man who is on the largest scales of human progress. And Chief Justice Warren's reply, "I can characterize mainly just as I can him, of goodwill, sweet." Then we rose up and went into the red room and the green room and the hall to speak to those people we'd missed and have some brandy and spend 10 minutes before the marvelous entertainment. In introducing one guest to another, I called her by the wrong name, even going on to add the wrong hometown. And from then on, the rest of the evening, felt about 14 years old and all thumbs and knees. At the very other end of the scale of poise and command was Miss Fontaine, who had something very nice to say to Lyndon. She liked his toast. The words brought tears to her eyes. I felt as good as I had bad a moment before. She also told me her dress was copied exactly after one she had had made 25 years before for a great occasion. I'd heard Molyneux had made her clothes, and she said the same dressmaker had made this one. I felt greatly flattered she'd had this made for her visit to the White House especially.